program is made possible in part by KBU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
KBOO in Portland. I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiede has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Mullen, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a legless Oregon veteran is leading a bicycle rally this weekend to protest U.S. foreign policies heavily dependent on oil.
The Bush administration is calling for the easing of surveillance restrictions in light of developing technology.
International diplomats met in Rome today to discuss a strategy in resolving the ongoing Israeli-Lebanon conflict.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq. As of today, there have been 2,567 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports as many as 43,927 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. The website informationclearinghouse.info reports the true civilian casualty rate is as high as a 250,000 dead.
This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 26, 2006. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afif Ahmed Shafi. Just as a new online poll showed he could play a pivotal role, State Senator Ben Westland, a Tumalo independent, turned in his first petition signatures in Bend yesterday in a bid to make the November 7th ballot. And he hopes play an even bigger role as the first independent elected governor since Julius Meyer in the 1930s. Westland brought to Deschutes County Clerk Nancy Blankenship 374 sheets containing almost 2,000 signatures, according to his campaign manager, Stacy Dykus. Statewide, the campaign has gathered about twice the 18,368 valid voter signatures needed to qualify for the ballot. That's despite not being able to count this year's major party primary voters, a rule change that Westland and his backers feel has created too unfair a hurdle for independent candidates. Westland will make similar stops at other county clerks' offices in the coming days. The new Zogby poll shows support split evenly between incumbent Democrat Ted Kolongoski and Republican challenger Ron Saxton, with a small share going Westland's way. But if Westland does not make the ballot, the poll shows voters leaning toward Kolongoski.
The Oregon AFL-CIO endorsed Governor Ted Kolongoski's re-election bid yesterday and took positions on several other races and initiative campaigns. Though expected, the move should help Kolongoski patch up his stormy relationship with his longtime allies in organized labor. The Labor Federation had stayed neutral in the May primary. But the largest union in the state federation, the Service Employees International Union, recently left the Oregon AFL-CIO because of the national split with organized labor. SEIU's parent union led the breakaway from the AFL-CIO last summer to co-found the rival Change to Win Federation, an earlier decision that allowed SEIU local unions to remain in the state and local AFL-CIO federations has been retracted. SEIU Local 503 backed Democrat Jim Hill in the primary. It remains one of the few unions in Oregon not to endorse Kulongoski's re-election bid, although it has agreed to oppose the candidacy of Republican Ron Saxton, Kulongoski's chief rival.
Oregon voters will have the opportunity to vote on whether they think parents should be notified when their minor teenage daughters are considering an abortion. Backers of parental notification turned in significantly more signatures than were necessary to qualify for ballot status. Supporters needed just 75,630 valid signatures to qualify, but led by Oregon Right to Life, they turned in 115,845 signatures to the Secretary of State office last month. According to the National Right to Life Committee, 22 states have parental consent laws in effect that require a parent to sign off on a teen's abortion before it can be done. Another 7 states have notification laws in place that require abortion facilities to notify a parent of a potential abortion beforehand. In 2004, 1,957 teen girls had abortions in Oregon, and 55% of minors did not tell either parent before they had it. The proposal includes a Supreme Court-mandated provision that teens be allowed to get an abortion through a judicial bypass in cases of medical emergencies or in abusive home situations. A January 2005 More Information poll found 74% favor parental notification on abortion, while just 21% oppose the idea.
Two groups in Glenview, Illinois, have pumped more than $1 million into Oregon ballot initiatives that would reimpose term limits and limit state spending. New campaign finance reports say a group called U.S. Term Limits contributed $510,000 on the Oregon Term Limits Initiative, almost all the money spent so far by that campaign. Supporters of the Spending Limit Initiative have spent more than $671,000 to qualify that measure. All but $100,000 of that came from Americans for Limited Government, another group from Glenview. Five other initiative campaigns reported more than $300,000 spending, including measures that would establish an open primary, change the way appellate court judges are elected, require notice to parents of teens seeking abortions, expand a state prescription drug program, and make access to health care a fundamental right in the Oregon Constitution.
The parents of a 29-year-old Marine captain who grew up in Oregon say their son, killed in Iraq, was a man of broad talents and interests. Now they say they can add the description hero. Captain Christopher T. Pate, who was listed from Portland, Oregon, died last Thursday at the age of 29 during combat in the Anbar province of Iraq, according to the Marine Corps. They say the Marines are telling them that Captain Christopher Pate used his last words to radio for help after a roadside bomb ripped through his patrol. Pate's interest took him from the Amazon River in South America to a study of languages and Eastern religions to athletics. His parents, Jerry and Kathy Pate, who live in Florida, say their son, a former Beaverton resident, was engaged to be married and would have left Iraq in November. They say they plan a private service in the Portland area. Pate joined the Marines in December 1999 and was promoted to captain in 2004, officials said.
A veteran who lost both legs protesting munitions shipments to Central America in the 1980s is leading a group of bicycle riders who are expected to pass through Salem today. The ride by Brian Wilson and others is intended to demonstrate actions that can contribute to the reduction of U.S. dependence on foreign sources of oil. The group thinks that the dependence is a major cause of current wars. The riders are scheduled to share a potluck meal with Salem peace activists and speak with them at 6:30 p.m. at the Friends Meeting House at 490 Northeast 19th Street in Salem. The public is invited to the free meeting. The ride, which starts in Eugene, will end in Seattle at the Veterans for Peace Annual Convention. The Salem appearance is being sponsored by Oregon Peace Works and the First United Congregational Church of Christ. For more information, call Oregon Peace Works at 503-585-2767.
The House has approved the creation of federal wilderness acres for California, Oregon, and Idaho. KBOO's DJ Wagner reports.
The House approved legislation Monday in one of a series of bills to protect national forest land in western states. The bills would create nearly 670,000 acres of new wilderness areas and protect 47 miles of wild and scenic rivers in California, Idaho, and Oregon, as well as ban drilling in northern New Mexico's Valley Vidal. The House also passed legislation to establish national heritage areas in several states, including New Mexico, Utah, and Nevada. The Oregon bill would create more than 77,200 acres of new wilderness preserves in the Mount Hood National Forest. The Idaho bill would designate three new wilderness areas comprising 315,215 acres in the rugged mountain peaks of the Sawtooth and Chalice National Forests, while conveying other public land to the state and local governments. It would also add 600 acres to the existing Sawtooth National Recreation Area. I am DJ Wagner, KBOO News.
A lightning-sparked wildfire was threatening 60 homes in eastern Oregon today, just west of the Snake River on the Idaho border. The McLean Creek fire has burned 1,500 acres of grass and timber since it ignited on Sunday. No evacuations have been ordered for residents of Pine Creek, where the threatened homes are located. The fire is also burning along a stretch of Highway 86 near Halfway. Governor Kulongoski officially declared the fire a conflagration today, a designation that allows the state fire marshal to call in available firefighting forces from around Oregon if local crews need help. Dozens of other wildfires were burning in eastern and central Oregon, but they were not threatening any structures at this time.
Air regulation agencies say benzene and gasoline in the Pacific Northwest is double the national average, and that proposed new federal rules won't help. The levels here are the highest in the nation, and the cancer-causing substances get into the air through exhaust fumes. Under rules to begin in 2011, Oregon and Washington gasoline still would contain twice the benzene levels as those on the East Coast. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that 42 cases of cancer for every million people are caused by a category of dangerous chemicals that include benzene. Sampling in Eugene shows that average ambient benzene levels are 10 times higher than the level believed to spur cancer over a lifetime. The EPA has not forced refineries in this region to upgrade gasoline, saying the air here was cleaner to start with.
With California utilities straining to meet demand, an Oregon utility has called on consumers to help reduce energy consumption. PacifiCor, the parent of Pacific Power, is asking customers to take such steps as setting air conditioning thermostats at 78 degrees or even at 85 when out of the house. The utility also recommends switching electricity use to off-peak hours in the morning and evening and emptying and unplugging secondary refrigerators or any other electrical equipment that is not in use. PacifiCor is based in Portland but serves more than 1.6 million customers in six western states, including California. A spokesman for other large utilities in Oregon, including Portland General Electric, said they support customer conservation efforts this week but have not called directly for measures to reduce demand.
An estimated 60,000 Oregon residents have a problem with gambling, and now the state is providing inpatient treatment to give some of them the help they need. The effort started today with seven state-funded beds contracted through Cascadia Behavioral Healthcare, a nonprofit organization that provides treatment for addiction. To qualify for care at the Salem Clinic, the gambler must live in Oregon and exhibit at least 5 of the 10 characteristics of the disorder, such as lying to hide gambling activity or stealing to fund the habit. Gambling counselors from across Oregon will decide which of their clients require inpatient treatment. An analysis of Oregon gamblers receiving state-funded treatment in 2003-2004 found the average age was 44 and nearly half were women. About 40% of those receiving treatment were married and owned their own home. The gamblers also reported an average gambling debt of about $24,000.
Oregon employers are using a federal program to increase their efforts to verify the immigration status of workers. The Basic Pilot Program lets employers verify documents supplied by job applicants by checking the Social Security Administration and the Department of Homeland Security online databases to confirm an employer's labor eligibility. Since last September, about 2,000 new employers nationwide have signed up with the voluntary program, pushing the total to more than 10,000, according to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which administers the program. Critics question whether the Social Security Administration and Homeland Security are capable of updating their databases as quickly as needed to make the program reliable.
University of Oregon researchers say helium atoms could be central in creating a new imaging approach using an atom camera. A newly devised nozzle fitted with a pinhole-sized capillary has allowed the scientists to distribute helium atoms with X-ray-like waves on randomly shaped surfaces. The researchers say that the technique could power development of a new microscope for nanotechnology, allowing for a non-invasive, high-resolution approach to studying both organic and inorganic materials. Physics professor Stephen Kavan said all that is needed is a camera-like detector, which is now being pursued to quickly capture images that offer nanometer resolution. The research is reported in the July 7th issue of the Physical Review of Letters.
Sea serpents may be a rare sight in Oregon, but the creature that emerged on the shore near Warrenton on Saturday might make a beachgoer's wonder. It was no heat-induced hallucination. It was a king of the salmon, which is not a salmon at all, but a kind of ribbon fish. The bizarre dweller of the briny deep is known to live along much of the Pacific coast, but in such low numbers that it's very rarely seen, biologists said. Given its appearance, it may just not go out in the public much. It is slender, about 6 feet long, with pale white skin and huge watery eyes. It's a bit of a ghost from the deep. The beast was spotted by a local couple near the Sunset Beach access road on Saturday morning when the coast was teeming with Portlanders escaping the heat. The couple called local authorities, who arrived not quite knowing what to expect. Records of ribbonfish are rare in Oregon, and marine biologists do not know much about them. They are thought to be few, solitary, and to live hundreds of feet in the water where their large eyes help them make better use of the scarce light.
The Washington Supreme Court upheld the state's ban on gay marriage today, dealing the gay rights movement its second major defeat in less than a month in a liberal-leaning state that was regarded as an especially promising battleground. The ruling leaves Massachusetts as the only state to allow gay marriage. In a 5-4 decision, the court said lawmakers have the power to restrict marriage to a man and woman, and it left intact the state's 1998 Defense of Marriage Act. Earlier this month, New York's High Court dealt gay couples a similar blow when it upheld a state law against same-sex marriage. The state Supreme Court overruled two lower courts that have found the ban violated the Washington Constitution's Privilege and Immunity section. However, three justices in the majority invited the legislature to take another look at the clear hardship that the ban causes for gay couples.
Spokane County Prosecutor Steve Tucker has hired a digital photography expert to review a surveillance videotape of a fatal confrontation between a mentally ill janitor and local police officers. Tucker says the review will help clarify inconsistencies between what was reported and what the videotape appears to show in the March 18th confrontation between Otto Zem and seven officers inside a North Spokane convenience store. Zem died 2 days after being beaten, shocked with a taser, and hogtied. The Spokane County Medical Examiner ruled Zem's death was a homicide. Tucker's investigation will determine whether it was the result of criminal acts by any of the officers. Tucker says there were no fingerprints on a 2-liter plastic bottle police contend Zem used in an aggressive manner. But the partially obscured surveillance video does not appear to show anything in Zem's hands while he retreated from baton-wielding officer Carl Thompson.
A female guard has been accused of sexual misconduct with two boys in the King County Juvenile Detention Center in Seattle. King County Prosecutor Norm Meleng announced a charge of custodial sexual misconduct today against the 34-year-old woman for behavior in 2001 and 2002. He says the boys were approached by the woman and given candy, food, and other privileges for numerous sexual encounters. The charge is part of a larger investigation at the juvenile jail, and four other officers are on administrative leave.
The largest planned housing development in Oakland in years is running into some legal opposition. In separate lawsuits, two citizens groups in California are suing to try to stop the planned Oak to Ninth waterfront housing development. Both groups are citing what they say are deficiencies in the project's environmental impact report. They say there should be more consideration for what impact the 3,100-unit project would have on air quality, traffic, and open space. One group filed suit Monday trying to secure more open space for the project. Another group filed a lawsuit on Friday trying to preserve a 1920s warehouse on the site.
The current time is 5:20. Still to come on the KBOO Evening News, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is calling for the investigation into the killings of UN officials in southern Lebanon. And hear how Chimp is aspiring to be the next World Series of Poker. You are listening to Community Radio KBOO in Portland, Vancouver, Corvallis, and Hood River.
Legal experts rang the alarm over proposed legislation to amend the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. They say the act diminishes congressional oversight while expanding the president's power, thereby giving him greater ability to spy on U.S. citizens. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
Jim Dempsey, policy director at the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington, D.C., is adamantly opposed to amending FISA as it has been proposed.
It would turn the clock back to an era of unchecked presidential power, warrantless domestic surveillance, and constitutional uncertainty.
But top officials in the intelligence community fully supported the proposal. CIA Director Michael Hayden.
Now, for NSA, the challenge is very acute. NSA intercepts communications, and it does so for only one purpose, to protect America, to protect the lives, the liberties, and the well-being of the citizens of the United States from those who would do us harm.
The proposal is an agreement between Chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee Arlen Specter and the Bush administration. Specter has spent 7 months looking for a way to rein in the president's so-called terrorist surveillance program to comply with the law and seek authorization through the courts of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. The surveillance program is intercepting communications of Americans without a warrant. The president maintains he has inherent authority to do just that. The legislation sends the program to the courts of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act for review, and it gives the president congressional authority to run the program. But critics fear an extension of presidential powers, including Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California.
Senator Specter's new FISA bill also eliminates the 15-day window on surveillance following a declaration of war. And This could be interpreted to mean that after a declaration of war, the president has unlimited wiretap authority till the end of the war.
Critics also say that Americans will be subject to wiretaps and surveillance, diminishing their privacy rights. Again, Jim Dempsey.
Your bill, Mr. Chairman, would authorize seizing the contents of purely domestic calls of American citizens without probable cause, without specific suspicion, where the call has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda or even with terrorism, would allow that surveillance to go on long term.
But Senator Spector defends his legislation. He calls the agreement a breakthrough. He was not persuaded by critics' calls.
Something about its being a simple concession to get the president to agree to send the surveillance program to the FISA court, I think it was an unprecedented concession. Haven't been able to find any time it's happened before that where legislation was proposed that the president had objected to, disagreed with, especially vociferously, that the president had agreed to legislation to what could amount to a curtailment of his authority.
Courts around the country are currently hearing cases on the surveillance program. A Missouri lawsuit brought by the Department of Justice says that a public commission cannot subpoena telephone company documents. Those companies are charged with giving customers information to the government. In an Illinois court, a similar case was thrown out. The judge sided with the Department of Justice, claiming that national security will be threatened because of information released in court proceedings. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
A troubling but little-known power used by President Bush to thwart laws he dislikes received a 1-2 punch this week. Both a panel of the American Bar Association and the top Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee are going after the White House's use of signing statements. The statements allow the president to sign a law, then add written reservations, often days or weeks later, that effectively undercut the law's intent. Traditionally, a president vetoes a bill with which he disagrees. In contrast, Bush vetoed his first measure, one expanding stem cell research after more than 5 years in office. He hasn't needed to reach for his veto pen because signing statements go one better. Senator Arlen Specter, the Pennsylvania Republican who heads the judiciary panel, wants to take these objections to the next level. He is writing a bill that will allow Congress to sue the White House over its tactics. Specter contends that the signing statements amount to an end run around lawmakers.
The Bush administration says technology has changed a lot since 1978, and Congress needs to change some restrictions to go with it. The administration is pushing the Senate Judiciary Committee to ease surveillance restrictions set out 28 years ago, saying those restrictions need to catch up with the Internet age and with developments like cell phones. Panel Chair Arlen Specter agreed to have the committee consider updating the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act as part of a deal he cut with President Bush. Among other things, in return, the president will let a court review his domestic spying program. Democrats say the proposed legislation is tilted too far in the president's favor, and they don't like that it will let a secret court determine whether Bush's program is legal. The administration has argued the restrictions have no bearing on the surveillance program in the war on terror. Panel Democrats at a hearing today say the program essentially violates federal law.
In Washington, the Senate unanimously passed a U.S.-India energy cooperation bill today. FSRN's Vinod Kajos has the details.
The energy cooperation bill calls for promoting dialogue and increased understanding between India and the U.S. on national energy policies and strategies. Supporters of the legislation call it an integral part of an expanding strategic partnership of the two countries. The energy bill makes sure that India changes its earlier state-subsidized energy policy to a new market-based approach. The U.S.-India Energy Security Cooperation Act of 2006 is seen by many observers as a curtain raiser for clinching another bill in the pipeline, U.S.-India Nuclear Cooperation Promotion Act 2006. From New Delhi in India. This is Vinod K. Jose for FSRN.
Former President Gerald Ford, 93, was admitted to a Colorado hospital for shortness of breath, but was expected to be released today, a hospital spokesman said. Ford was taken to Vail Valley Medical Center in Colorado on Monday afternoon. The former president spent about 10 days at a California hospital in January, where he was treated for pneumonia. Ford, who took office in 1974 after Richard Nixon resigned amid the Watergate scandal, also spent time in a hospital in December for what his office said were routine tests. He suffered a mild stroke in 2000 and was hospitalized briefly in 2003 after suffering dizzy spells while playing golf in the desert heat near Palm Springs, California.
Iraq's prime minister continued his visit in Washington, D.C. today, speaking before a joint session of Congress. Prior to the speech, some Democratic lawmakers criticized the Iraqi prime minister's comments regarding the Israeli attack on Lebanon, but a threatened boycott by some Congress members never materialized. As FSRN's Darby Hickey reports from Capitol Hill, despite differences with the administration over the fighting in Lebanon, the Iraqi prime minister spoke in terms squarely supporting President Bush's contention that the situation in Iraq is improving.
Dr. Nouri al-Maliki, Iraq's first prime minister after countrywide elections last year, received a standing ovation from both chambers of Congress prior to, during, and after his speech Wednesday morning. With midterm elections looming in the U.S., lawmakers on both sides of the aisle were hoping al-Maliki's speech would support their analysis of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. But during the 25-minute-long address, the Iraqi prime minister expressed a perspective similar to President George Bush, that Iraq is the front line of the war on terror and that not enough attention is being paid to the great progress made since the U.S. invasion 3 years ago.
The transformation in Iraq can sometimes be forgotten in the daily futile violence. Since liberation, we have witnessed great accomplishments in politics, the economy, and civil society.
Prime Minister al-Maliki thanked the U.S. for its involvement in Iraq, asked that the troop presence not end until Iraqi forces are better prepared to handle the country's security, and subtly urged for more support from the U.S. government. Despite his declarations that Iraq is fully aligned with the U.S. in the war on terror, some members of Congress were not convinced. Senator Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois.
I will tell you that there were many questions raised before his speech, and I was one of the chorus raising them, about his position on Hezbollah. This morning I asked him directly, do you believe that Hezbollah is a terrorist organization? He did not respond. He would not respond to that question.
More than 20 Democrats had called for al-Maliki's address to be canceled after the Iraqi prime minister said Israel should stop its attacks on Lebanon. Many of those lawmakers boycotted the speech. Al-Maliki's speech contradicted his previous demands for a timetable for U.S. troops to leave Iraq, said Riyad Jarar, an Iraqi activist currently in D.C. Jarar said the Iraqi prime minister is caught between the demands of the Bush administration and the demands of the Iraqi public.
If al-Maliki actually apologized for his very strong critique for the Israeli war against Lebanon, he will be totally discredited inside Iraq, and he will lose even the small support that he's having now.
An activist with the anti-war group Code Pink momentarily disrupted al-Maliki's speech, chanting, "Troops home now." For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
Federal environmental officials are giving a big thumbs down to a plan for a hydroelectric power plant in the Cleveland National Forest. The $1.3 billion plan for a plant that would generate power for some 350,000 inland homes calls for using Morrell Canyon above Lake Elsinore as a water reservoir. But a recently released U.S. Environmental Protection Agency report says the canyon hosts a network of springs that make up a rare sloping wetlands habitat. The report says flooding the canyon is likely to contribute to a significant degradation of waters of the United States. Officials with Vista-based Nevada Hydro Company and the Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District have to respond to the EPA's concerns in their final report. A Nevada Hydro spokesman says a different canyon would be used for the project instead.
The Boeing company has reported a $160 million loss for the second quarter on more than $1 billion in charges. Those charges include the steep cost to settle a Justice Department investigation into Boeing's defense contracting. The world's largest aerospace company reduced its 2006 earnings guidance because of the charges today, but raised its estimates for next year. Boeing cited the strength of its commercial airplane business, a modestly growing defense business, and increased productivity. The loss was the first in 3 years for Boeing, which is based in Chicago, and came in a year in which its commercial aircraft business has seen a resurgence while rival Airbus has struggled. The net loss for the quarter amounted to 21 cents per share, and compared with net earnings a year earlier of $566 million, or 70 cents per share.
A Los Angeles judge has ruled on a case brought against the city by the South Central Farmers. FSRN's Gabriel San Roman has more.
The Honorable Judge Helen I. Bendix ruled against the South Central Farmers today in the case of the South Central Farmers versus the City of Los Angeles and land developer Ralph Horowitz. Attorneys for the farmers had argued that the 2003 sale of the 14-acre piece of land by the city to Ralph Horowitz constituted public waste and was unlawfully transacted. Horowitz purchased the land from the city for only $5 million. Attorneys for the farmers contend that the selling price was too low and unfair to LA City taxpayers. The court decision comes after Los Angeles County sheriffs evicted farmers and activists from the land on June 13th. The lawsuit was the farmers' last legal hope for retaining the land. Attorneys for the farmers may appeal the decision. For FSRN, this is Gabriel San Roman in Los Angeles.
San Jose Mayor Ron Gonzalez is expected to plead not guilty today to public corruption charges for his part in an alleged garbage-related scheme. Prosecutors allege Gonzalez pressured NorCal Waste Systems into using Teamsters instead of lower-paid union workers at a recycling plant. Prosecutors say Gonzalez then secretly agreed to help the trash contractor recoup the extra labor expenses at a taxpayer cost of $11.2 million. Gonzalez was charged with six felonies in an indictment unsealed last month, including conspiracy, bribery, misappropriating public funds, and falsifying records. If convicted, he could face up to 8 years in prison.
Zombies lurching down a downtown street tend to cause a stir, but when the living dead carry duffel bags and backpacks with what look like wires sticking out, that's when the cops step in. This horror show unfolded Saturday evening in Minneapolis, where officers arrested six ghoulish revelers in thick makeup who police say were staggering along like zombies near 6th Street and Hennepin Avenue. All six were booked into the Hennepin County Jail under a post-9/11 Minnesota statute, making it a felony to simulate weapons of mass destruction. Dressing up like characters from the movie Night of the Living Dead might have been okay, but toting bags with what police said appeared to be protruding wires apparently crossed a line. A friend of the group said the arrests were overkill and that the suspicious devices were homemade stereos. Zombie dances and raves have been around for some time. Last fall, for example, nearly 200 people, most shrouded in tattered clothes and bluish makeup, participated in a zombie pub crawl in northeast Minneapolis.
The time is 5:34, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Code Red Alert. Your Department of Homeland Security is at it again. This bungling bureaucratic behemoth, which is spending billions of our tax dollars supposedly to protect America from another 9/11 horror, is second only to the Pentagon in mismanagement, waste, fraud, and plain silliness. The latest evidence of DHS's goofy incompetence comes from its own Inspector General, who recently issued a scathing indictment of how the department divvies up the hundreds of millions of dollars it grants annually for local anti-terrorism efforts. DHS maintains a national asset database that lists 77,000 local sites across America that it considers possible terrorist targets. Using this computerized list of targets, DHS bizarrely cut grants going to New York City and our nation's capital this year by 40%, while jacking up the amounts going to such places as Omaha and Louisville. Why? Peek into DHS's database. The Inspector General reports that it includes such potential targets as the Amish Country Popcorn Store in Indiana, the Old McDonald's Petting Zoo in Alabama, and the Mule Day Parade in Tennessee. The list is larded with some 3,700 malls, 1,300 casinos, water parks, cruise ships, and even 718 mortuaries. No doubt these places are national assets, but terrorist targets? Even in the face of such absurdity, DHS won't budge. "We don't find it embarrassing," declares a clueless department spokesman. "The list is a valuable tool." Many of those on the list, however, disagree. "Seems like someone has gone overboard," says an organizer of an apple and pork festival in Illinois, which made DHS's target list. He notes that their time could be spent better doing other things, like providing security for the country. This is Jim Hightower saying, bingo, let's make this guy the head of DHS.
This Jim Hightower commentary has been brought to you by the United Steelworkers, the union committed to winning every employee's right to choose representation free from fear of being intimidated or fired. Visit us on the World Wide Web at usw.org.
Stay tuned to Independent Native News following our newscast at 6 p.m. here, The Underground. At 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Tomorrow's weather, a few clouds in the morning, but mainly sunny, high 83 degrees. Thank goodness. Chance of precipitation, 0%. And for you folks in the Columbia Gorge, it will be a sunny one with a high of 89 degrees. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
Rome hosted an international conference on the Middle East conflict today with diplomats from the U.S., UN, EU, Italy, Egypt, and Lebanon. The international talks aimed at creating a common strategy to resolve the ongoing violence between Israel and Lebanon, now in its 15th day. FSRN's Diletta Varlis reports.
Representatives of U.S., UN, EU, Egypt, Lebanon, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia arrived in Rome this morning to negotiate an end to the regional war that has erupted in the Middle East. U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice arrived this morning in Rome, flying directly from Israel. Lebanon Prime Minister Fouad Siniora had already arrived yesterday in the Italian capital. The meeting was held by Italy and U.S. with the presence of UN Chief Kofi Annan. Representatives from the main warring parties, Israel and Hezbollah, refused to be present. Neither Syria nor Iran were invited. Prime Minister of Lebanon, Fouad Siniora.
For the past 15 days, we are being pounded every day. And scores of people are dying every day. And scores are really being injured. And the country is being cut to pieces so that really to bring the country to its knees, and that's what's happening. That was an opportunity to present our case to all those who are in the conference and really wanted to express our demands that for so many years part of our country is still occupied, which is represented by the Shebaa farms, which is still occupied by Israel, and there are other things that there are some of our detainees that are being still held in Israeli prisons. And Israel up till now is denying to give Lebanon the maps for the landmines that it has planted during the time when it was occupying that part of Lebanon.
The first focal point of this meeting was the creation of a humanitarian aid corridor to deliver supplies to the Lebanese population. The second point was to send a UN peace force to be positioned to the southern border of Lebanon with Israel. And an accepted agreement by the participant was to include Syria in this process with the possible condition of setting a UN presence on the border between Syria and Lebanon. During the meeting, U.S. Secretary of State Rice repeatedly remarked that Israel has a right to defend itself.
The international community made a pledge to the people of Lebanon when we passed Resolution 1559 that we would help Lebanon, the government of Lebanon, to establish its authority fully within its country as a sovereign state without the interference of its neighbors, and as a state that could fully exercise its control throughout its territory and that would have a complete control over any means of violence. In other words, that there would not be militias, but rather one authority and one gun.
According to the New York Times, at the beginning of the Israeli-Lebanon conflict, at the request of Israel, the U.S. used the largest U.S. military base in Italy, Camp Derby, to transfer in secret a cache of bunker buster bombs to Israel. On July the 15th, Tel Aviv bought a massive amount of anti-bunker bombs called Sirius Guided Bombs Unit 28 or GBU 28. These bunker buster bombs are designed to penetrate 30 meters beneath the soil and 6 meters below concrete. General Secretary of UN Kofi Annan said he was very concerned about the attack by Israeli military on UNFIL, the UN mission in Lebanon since 1968, which resulted in the deaths of 4 UN observers. Kofi Annan requested to Israel a detailed investigation on the fact, while Israel Prime Minister Olmert kept saying it was an accident. BBC reports that UN workers in the building had notified several times the opposition to Israeli military before being bombed. Today's Rome meeting finished with a disagreement between U.S. and the rest of the participants to the timeline of intervention. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Diletta Varlese from Italy.
As many as 13 Israeli soldiers were killed during a drive to take a village considered a Hezbollah stronghold along the Lebanese border today. Meanwhile, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan called for an investigation into the killing of four members of a UN force in southern Lebanon today. FSRN's Jackson Ollers has more from Beirut.
Lebanese Red Cross officials today brought the burned-out remains of two ambulances hit by Israeli missile fire on Sunday to a hotel in the southern coastal city of Tyr to show proof that Israeli warplanes have indeed been hitting emergency vehicles. More than 400 Lebanese civilians have been killed in the last 2 weeks, with the majority of them coming from villages caught in the heavy bombardment of southern Lebanon. Civilian deaths continue to rise as convoys carrying fleeing refugees have also come under increasing fire by Israeli aircraft. According to sources in the south of Lebanon, Israel conducted a simultaneous aerial and artillery attack at the UN post on the eastern Lebanese border today, despite the fact that it was a well-established and clearly marked building. Israel has said it will launch an investigation into the killing of the four UN peacekeepers, but denies that the military deliberately targeted the UN observer post. Reporting from Beirut, Lebanon, this is Jackson Ellis for Free Speech Radio News.
As the Israeli invasion of the Gaza Strip enter its fifth week, Palestinians came together to propose a negotiated solution with Israel, but Israeli officials rejected the offer. FSRN's Syed Banura reports.
At least 9 civilians, including 3-year-old Suad Nasser Habib, were killed today in the latest Israeli airstrikes in the Gaza Strip. One of the morning's airstrikes was aimed at Palestinian Authority headquarters in Gaza City, following a night-long assault on a Palestinian government building in Ramallah last night. After last week's destruction of the Palestinian government complex in Nablus by Israeli forces, Palestinian government officials note that not much is left of the Palestinian Authority's government and police forces. Youssef Rizka, the Palestinian Minister of Information.
Israel is targeting facilities that belong to the Palestinian government. The ministries of foreign affairs, interior, information, and finance have been destroyed, and the Palestinian legislators have been arrested under false charges. Israel would like the Palestinian government to collapse and be divided. Israel wants to create chaos in the internal Palestinian arena in order to create a new order inside Palestine. This is what we can read from the latest Israeli attacks.
Meanwhile, Palestinian factions last night came to an agreement to cease rocket fire into Israel and release the captured soldier. But Israel has thus far refused to negotiate. Abu Ubaidah with the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas.
Our position was clear since the beginning. We were intending to end this fight fast, and we expressed willingness to negotiate to end the crisis as quickly as possible. Our conditions have always been clear, and we were willing to cooperate with any mediation to end the crisis. But the Zionist enemy was unwilling, and that is why there have been no negotiations. We won't accept a ceasefire as long as the Israeli crimes continue against the Palestinian people.
George Abu Zuluf with the Defense for Children International in Gaza expressed dismay that children have been killed and continue to be killed in the ongoing Israeli invasions.
Today in the international conference in Rome, everybody is speaking about international force in South Lebanon to protect the Israeli civilians from Hezbollah attacks. While we are under the Israeli heavy attacks since 6 years, and we were asking, we need international protection. But nobody was listening to us. And children, I believe, are paying the heavy price.
For FSRN from imemc.org, this is Saad Banura in Beit Sahur, Palestine.
A Japanese research team plans to raise environmental awareness by entering a race car in the Dakar Rally this year that runs on cooking oil used to fry tempura. The turbo-enhanced Land Cruiser 100 will be the first car completely powered by biodiesel to enter the prestigious event, said a lecturer at Osaka Sangyo University, which helped test the fuel and provide technical support. Driving the car will be former Formula One racer Yukio Kariyama. The Dakar Rally will start in Lisbon, Portugal next January. The race tests physical and mechanical endurance over 10,000 kilometers of rough terrain and parched desert to Dakar, the capital of Senegal, the westernmost country on the African continent. Onaka said the team will need about 10,000 liters of tempura oil, which will be donated by students and the school cafeteria, as well as by neighborhood restaurants near the university. The fuel will be reprocessed before use by biofuel maker Revo International in Kyoto.
In Mexico, the coalition that supported the center-left candidate in the country's contested presidential election has filed a criminal complaint against election authorities. FSRN's Vladimir Flores reports.
The coalition of leftist political parties filed a criminal complaint yesterday against members of Mexico's Federal Electoral Institute. The complaint accuses electoral authorities of failing to uphold rules by doing nothing to prevent companies from paying for ads that attacked the character of center-left candidate Andrés Manuel López Obrador. The criminal complaint filed yesterday is in addition to a legal complaint which calls for a ballot-by-ballot recount of the very close election. Conservative candidate Felipe Calderón has refused to back a call for a ballot recount. The Federal Electoral Institute has until the end of August to rule on a recount and until the 6th of September to declare a president-elect. Vladimir Flores, Free Speech Radio News.
Germany's education system places students in distinct tiers, setting a basic, vocational, or academic track for all students by the age of 10. Critics say the system places immigrant children who are learning a new language and adapting to a new country at a disadvantage. Immigrant children are more likely to end up in the lower, basic, and vocational tiers of the German education system before they have had a real chance to develop their skills. FSRN's Cinnamon Nepard reports.
Janina Zern from the Social Science Research Center in Berlin says that children with migrant backgrounds are disproportionately represented in the lower tiers of the school system.
20% leave it without any certificate. About 40% have the certificate of the lowest school track, 30% of the medium one, and only 10% do have the certificate of the gymnasium, the certificate that allows you to study at university.
Children of academics or professionals are four times more likely to go to university than children of working class and migrant parents. Once you're in a school, it's very difficult to move up to a higher tier. In fact, it's more common for students to drop down. Zern says that children of migrants are on the back foot from the outset due to their lack of German language skills.
They are not given the opportunity to learn German properly, especially before they enter school. And during school, they don't get enough support to improve these competencies. So I think socioeconomic background plus language problems are one of the key components why you see these large ethnic inequalities in education.
Kenneth Frisser, spokesperson for the Senator for Education, Youth and Sports in Berlin, says that over the past 5 years, steps have been made to tackle this problem in Berlin.
We have started to work much more and much earlier with these migrant children. The kindergartens we have are no longer facilities where we just watch that the children don't hurt themselves, but they are educational facilities. We start teaching language, teaching basics on sciences to children before they even reach school, because we know that these things are not taught in many migrant families, but also in German families. That is our main strategy. But of course, school can only repair to a certain amount the deficits that parents are not capable of bringing to their children. School cannot repair everything.
Although these changes are being made in some states, not all teachers have adequate training to deal with classes that are ethnically diverse. Regina Weber from the National Union of Students.
The teachers do not get the special education how they should focus on the special problems of children with migrant background. And I think that's a problem because they can't give them the special support they need because they simply don't know how to do it.
The short length of the German school day, from 8:30 until 1 p.m., has also come under attack. While another problem is that there's no national education standard, it's up to each of the 16 states to implement their own strategies. But Kenneth Frisser, spokesperson for the Senator for Education, Youth and Sports in Berlin, says following the poor PISA test results, the states have now come up with a plan and are working together. But even he admits that the three-tiered system is not ideal.
If we were to start in the year zero, I'm sure no one would invent this three-tiered system again. But we have a three-tiered system now, and we're going to improve this system wherever we can.
German education ministers say that reforming the system would take between 10 and 15 years. Andreas Schleicher, education expert at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, says that this is too slow. It will be too late for many children, but at least some change is happening.
For Free Speech Radio News in Berlin, I'm Cinnamon Nippard.
The stakes have been raised in the case against former Guatemalan military leaders accused of perpetrating genocide in the late 1970s and 1980s. Spanish Judge Santiago Pedraz issued international arrest warrants for the nation's former dictator, along with seven other former authorities. As FSRN's Jill Replogle reports, carrying out the arrest warrants will be a major test for Guatemala's political and justice system.
Some 2.5 decades ago, Guatemala was the scene of some of the most heinous war crimes committed in Latin America in the 20th century. The main perpetrators were the Guatemalan military, police, and other state-sponsored security forces. Most of the victims were Maya indigenous people. Justice is still pending for the vast majority of war victims in Guatemala. But now some of the leaders accused of ordering massacres, torture, and forced disappearances are closer than ever to a courtroom, though not a Guatemalan one. Maya indigenous leader and Nobel Peace Prize winner Rigoberto Menchú brought a case against the former leaders before the Spanish justice system in 1999. The future of the case was uncertain until last year, when Spain's constitutional court ruled that the Guatemalan leaders could be tried for crimes against humanity, even if Spanish citizens were not affected. Eduardo de León, executive director of the Rigoberto Menchú Foundation.
Es una etapa para nosotros sumamente importante.
This is a very important stage because, for the first time, the accused are nearing direct contact with the courts. Our goal has always been that they demonstrate before the tribunals their innocence or guilt for the crimes that they are accused of.
The accused were in fact supposed to testify in late June in a Guatemalan court with the Spanish Judge Pedraz present, but the hearings were blocked by a series of appeals from the defendant's lawyers. Pedraz returned early to Spain and issued the arrest warrants a week later. Though just issuing the arrest warrants was a major step, carrying them out will be even more difficult. Again, Eduardo de León.
Por lo menos, los imputados tendrán como cárcel.
At least the accused will have their own country as their jail. But I think the best security wall they have is Guatemala. There is no other way to explain why they are still free, why they haven't been put on trial, why they still have power.
The most notorious of the accused, Efraín Ríos Montt, still has lots of power in Guatemala. According to United Nations Truth Commission, the majority of wartime massacres and other human rights abuses took place when Ríos Montt was president. Now he's the secretary general of one of the country's main political parties. He even ran for president in Guatemala's last elections in 2003. A few days after Pedraz issued the arrest warrants, Ríos Montt called a press conference at the National Congress. Here he declared his innocence and defended the army's actions during the civil war as necessary to save the country from communism.
The army wasn't a group of assassins. It was a group of men who acted and reacted to defend the interests of the nation and the people.
Some worry that the power still held by Ríos Montt and other former leaders could keep them from going to trial. Yolanda Perez is a public defender and president of the National Lawyers Association in Guatemala. She says whether or not the arrest warrants are carried out is up to the current government.
From my point of view, the state should carry out the order based on international law. That holds precedence over ordinary laws. But being realistic, it's a political decision. The state has to define its position.
The Guatemalan Foreign Relations Ministry should be the first to receive the arrest warrants. To date, they say they haven't received any notice from Spain. When they do, the Guatemalan government's will to comply with international justice will be put to the test. Jill Replogle, FSRN, Guatemala City.
Ladies and gentlemen, a chimp will be playing in the 2006 World Series of Poker main event. And no, that is not a derogatory reference to the President of the United States. PokerShare.com online gambling is to sponsor Mikey the Chimp in the WSOP main event. Mikey has been trained in Hold'em. He recognizes the shapes and colors of suits, and his favorite move is going all in. Mikey was found during a nationwide search as the world's best non-human poker player. PokerShare have promised to pay anyone who can knock out Mikey this year to return to next year's World Series main event. Mikey is a chimp that is nearing the end of his professional career. He has appeared on the cover of Vogue, a Black Eyed Peas CD cover, and various other publications. His website, monkeyshare.net, will show video footage of Mikey practicing for the tournament. So whip up those banana splits and banana flavor vodka, because it ain't just real birds and poker Alice's living on the river now. Primates are poker's new fast company.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 26, 2006. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland and Corvallis at 100.7 FM on transmitter K264AA and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Noah Eaton. Our assistant producer is Mike Monkbolt. Tonight's audio editors are Mike Monkbolt and Joshua Eichen. Special thanks to reporters DJ Wagner and Jacob Funston. Our engineer is Ian Campbell. The KBOO's guest evening news and public affairs director for this evening is Noah Eaton. I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., join us for the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, join us for Joanne Bowman hosting Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. And at 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know. Don't go away, because at 9:30, hear an interview with writer John McNally, author of America's Report Card, a political novel that explores the nefarious world of standardized testing and the government's intrusion into and manipulation of our personal information. But if you didn't join us for that, then join us at 10 for Mia Kim, who's presenting North Korea with the stories of local musicians who recently visited that country. At 10:30 on Art Focus, host Julie Bernard speaks with Portland artist Eva Lake about her current exhibit at the Ogden Gallery. And if you missed all of that stuff, well, then by all means, do join us at 11, because it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. That's all right here on KBOO, your community, nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored radio station. Thanks for joining us, and stay cool out there.
Board of Directors. The orientation is Saturday, July 29th, 10 a.m. to noon at KBOO. You will have the chance to chat with current board members about the responsibilities and opportunities that come with being on the Board of Directors, and also what kind of work is ahead for the board over the next year. That's an orientation for prospective board members, Saturday, July 29th, 10 a.m. to noon at KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th. See you there.
There'll be a live remote from Andaz at the Fez Ballroom, Saturday, July 29th.
With Anjali and the Incredible Kid on KBOO 90.7 FM. We'll be celebrating 4 years of throwing Desi parties in Portland, presenting the best UK Bhangra, Asian hip-hop, R&B, and Bollywood.
If you're 21 or over, you can come and join the party at 316 Southwest 11th Avenue. Or listen to KBOO 90.7 FM or online at kboo.fm.
That's Saturday, July 29th from 9 p.m. to 1 a.m.